You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, March 30th, 2017. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Tanya Erzin, associate professor at the University of Puget Sound, on her book, God in Captivity, The Rise of Faith-Based Prison Ministries in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Speaking of incarceration, Bridgegate accomplices get prison time. Is Chris Christie still on the hook? Meanwhile, James Comey claims he wanted to tell us, as Senate Intel hearings set to begin, a House Intel hearings, who knows if there's still even a House Intel committee. And does a governmental shutdown loom? Donald Trump taking it to the Freedom Caucus in a tweet.
Not good.
Meanwhile, President Trump to call for more civilian deaths in Somalia. Climate change no longer exists at the Department of Energy office that deals with climate change.
Power of positive thinking.
North Carolina lawmakers come up with a lame compromise to supposedly repeal their hate law. And Trump's plan to deal with opioid addiction, not so much. All that and more on today's Majority Report, ladies and gentlemen. A fairly quiet day. I mean, you know, 24 hours, right? We haven't had any major revelation that on money laundering or involvement with, hacking, or we haven't had a wholesale failure of our government to do something. We've just had more normal times would be the outrageous actions of basically widening our war in Somalia, just so that we could bring some parity, I guess, to our widening involvement in Yemen.
Have some W's.
You don't want Somalia to feel like we're neglecting them and just killing more civilians in Yemen. You don't want something like that to happen. And, of course, the assault on our strategies, I guess, and any policies to mitigate climate change. And then, of course, we don't even know what's happening at places like the Department of Education, right? I mean, there's so much low-grade destruction going on in our government every day that we just aren't aware of. This is the nature of having a Republican executive branch. The only other thing I can tell you in terms of news that is brewing, and we will get to much of these stories later in the program, but Claire McCaskill now has basically come out against the filibuster. So that's two of the eight that Democrats could afford to lose. Not terribly surprising. It really does appear, knock on wood, that, and I haven't seen any whip counts because I just don't think people have announced, but it does feel like the momentum, the trend, is going to be towards filibustering Gorsuch. And certainly as his hearings performance marinates, I'm seeing less support for his, for him just personally. With that said, there are tens of millions of dollars being spent around the country and if you live in one of those states with a Democratic senator who's up for re-election in 2018, you're probably more conscious of it than we are here. But there are tens of millions of dollars being spent to put pressure on these senators to not vote for the filibuster, because I think Mitch McConnell really, really doesn't want to be in that position of trying to pull the nuclear option. And I'm not sure that he's convinced that he has the senators lined up on the Republican side. So we will see all that. Now, let's just talk briefly about another story. Ivanka Trump, back in November 13th, she told in an interview, now what? Where was this? In a Roman Colosseum? Where did they hold this interview? Was it on the set of, did they find that HBO set? What was that show? Rome?
Rome.
Is that, they find that on the set? For some reason, whatever it is, they shot this on the former set of Rome, or maybe, I don't know, what was that? What's that huge opera? I can't remember now. And Leslie Stahl is asking Ivanka Trump about her plans.
People think that you're going to be part of the administration, Ivanka.
I'm going to be a daughter. But I've said throughout the campaign that I'm very passionate about certain issues and that I want to fight for them. So, you know, there are a lot of things that I feel deeply strongly about, but not in a formal administrative capacity.
Hey, what happened?
Well, what happened was that she realized that, there's probably some cash to be made here. And the White House announced officially that Ivanka Trump is no longer just going to have an office, a first daughter office, and first daughter security clearance. But in the grand tradition that we see in places like the Assads of Syria, or with Saddam Hussein and yes. Uday and Qusay, I imagine there's plenty more examples of this in Jordan.
I wish Eric and Junior had a little bit more of that fight in them.
Yes. Ivanka Trump is moving into the administration, now going to be an unpaid federal employee, unpaid at least directly by the government.
Paid by China.
There's some side deals that may be forthcoming. I also wonder, and I need to talk to someone about this, but it occurred to me today. I wonder what the implications are of requiring someone to testify when they are working the executive branch. At that point, can you use executive privilege, maybe to avoid answering some questions that you wanted to, that if you end up in front of a Senate Intelligence Committee.
Jews are so clever.
We'll see.
You're thinking.
We'll
You're
see.
Thinking.
We'll
look at,
see.
Look at that brain.
I don't know. I mean, maybe it was just because they're so concerned about ethics consideration that that seems likely.
Sorry, she can't go to Aspen, Jared. She's got an official role in the White House now.
Well, of course, Jared does,
also,
too.
It's also date night.
That's right. All right, well, that's that in terms of Ivanka Trump. I'm sure the saga on that will continue. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Tania Erzin about the prison ministries that seem to be taking over and I imagine are going to multiply during our private prison bonanza that we're about to see. We'll be right back in just a moment.
Something you said to me, but I can't explain it. Something you said to me, I know you've asked it. Somehow you found me, the words are in motion. Somehow you found me, the words are in motion now. I got locked in myself.
We are back, Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Associate Professor of Religion and Gender Studies at the University of Puget Sound and the Executive Director of the Freedom Education Project, Puget Sound, which is a nonprofit that provides college education for incarcerated women. Tanya Erzin on the rise of faith-based prison ministries in the age of mass incarceration. Welcome to the program, Tanya.
Thank you.
So, first off, I mean, give us a sense of how you came onto this topic. I mean, obviously, right now the mass incarceration is a relatively, I mean, people are starting to talk about this issue in a way that I think it's never had such a large amount of attention. Nor opportunities, supposedly, because there seems to be a sort of a transpartisan notion that we need to do something about the carceral state in this country. Although, as of late, it may be going in the wrong direction. But what drove you to look at this specific aspect of incarceration in this country?
Well, I had taught early in 2002 and 3 in a women's prison on the West Side Highway in New York City, and that prison actually has since closed. It's now going to be an organization that does work for women internationally. And during that time, Jeb Bush was governor of Florida. Under his administration, they actually changed about 7 state prisons into faith-based character institutions. And so this whole notion that state prisons would then become oriented toward rehabilitating people through religion. And if you look, it was also around the same time that there was a lawsuit between Americans United for the Separation of Church and State and Prison Fellowship Ministry, which is a very large evangelical prison ministry around the country and the world, because they were taking over and running evangelical programs in the wings of state prisons. And so I was interested in this legal issue, but also having been in prisons, noticing that really, the majority of people you see in there, beside the prisoners and the families and friends that come visit them, are religious volunteers, and they tend to be overwhelmingly Christian.
No, wait a second. So tell us about Jeb Bush did. He changed the prisons into faith-based care facilities?
Yeah, so Florida has a lot of private prisons, but they also have state prisons that are now called faith-based character institutions. And the idea is that faith and character building are the optimal ways that you can rehabilitate or transform a person. And it started because a non-denominational evangelical Christian megachurch started operating a dorm in one of the prisons there, and then it expanded to the whole prison. So they use the term faith-based, and I'm using that term on the cuff of my book, but faith is a word that's supposed to connote that it's ecumenical, that it's across religious groups, when in actuality, the majority of religious groups coming in are Christian, and they're Protestant Christian, and they tend to be theologically and socially conservative. And so the one Florida prison, when I visited it early after they switched to being a faith-based prison, that megachurch had built and paid for a new chapel in the prison. And it was, you know, it had a sound system and instruments and a big screen. And it was the only building in the whole prison that was air conditioned, right? And this is Central Florida, and people are living in these open air dorms. And so, you know, what kind of benefits do you get? What are the advantages if you actually participate in a faith-based program versus what other choices do you have?
So as someone who's convicted of a crime and I'm sent to a state penitentiary in Florida, can I opt out of a faith-based character institution, or do I get sent there? I mean, is it basically a prison, but they just call it something different?
So you know, actually most people apply to get into those prisons because they tend to be viewed as having more programming, as safer, and there's advantages. As coercive as it is, there's advantages to participating in those programs. And so actually, you know, people would be, if you were hypothetically sent to one of those prisons, there would be somebody who wanted to take your place there from another prison if you didn't want to be there.
If I was getting really Jewy about it.
And there are not, you know, and this is the thing, you know, there aren't comparable groups and funding and resources for other religious traditions. And so you go into the prison libraries and there are very few books on other religious traditions. There's a lot of misinformation about them. In that same prison, when I went there, the Muslim study group was very small and they were meeting in essentially the equivalent of a broom closet. There were very few resources for Jewish prisoners. And then there's a whole other trend, which I look at, and that's prisons, especially in the South, where the only way to get a college degree, an AA or BA, is through a Baptist seminary, and it's a degree in Christian ministry. And the idea is that people are trained, and then they're sent out to other prisons as missionaries. And I'm using that term because that's what they are in practice, but they call them agents of moral rehabilitation. And in those prisons, the only way to get any kind of education is through a Baptist seminary. And they have very small numbers of non-Christian people in that, but they're incredibly marginalized because this is a proselytizing faith. The idea is they're training people to evangelize. So as a non-Christian in that program, again, how do you negotiate those tensions and those differences?
And all this, I mean, I want to read a quote from your book, because all of the core of what you found seems to emanate from this predicate. You write, the rise of post-1970s mass incarceration is not therefore merely about prisons per se, but more broadly about a transformation in the systems that define and distribute human value, including what precisely humans deserve and who's accountable to provide this for them. Programs in prison are part of this equation. And then you go on to say several women at Bedford Hills Correctional Facility, women in New York, evaluated the effects of a college program there, writing in a co-authored article, quote, rehabilitation looks like radical language now that punishment is the explicit project of incarceration. These faith-based programs sort of amp that up, don't they?
Yeah, and they emerge to a large extent after, you know, in the late 70s and 1980s, when you have the decline of really any pretense of rehabilitation in many prisons and in cuts in state funding. And so, and as the prison population skyrockets, and as you said, the carceral state gets bigger and more massive, that you have so many faith-based groups coming in who claim two things. They say, we can rehabilitate people more effectively than any secular program because we can change them from the inside out. And then they also say, and we'll save the state money because we'll provide this, you know, for free, but obviously there's in-kind support through the state and through the prison, but we will do this by bringing in volunteers. And so faith-based groups are running college programs and mental health and addiction programs and trauma counseling and all kinds of services that were formerly provided by the state. So it's also about a form of privatization.
And the notion of rehabilitation, I mean, I think at times in the book question really if that's really the agenda.
Right. I think the groups, and many of them say that, they see prisons as a mission field. It's a captive population. Other people have called it a carceral church. People in prison, especially people serving really long sentences, and I spent time in Angola prison where 4,800 out of 6,000 men are serving life without the possibility of parole. You know, for them, faith-based groups provide contact with outsiders, a lifeline to the outside world. And it's again, in Angola, it's the only way to get any kind of education degree. So, you know, I think people use it in different ways. I think people also have experienced profound transformation through religion, but the groups themselves seem very intent on saving individuals, as I say in the book, rather than looking at a system that puts them there in the first place. And I was really fortunate to get to know someone who spent 27 years in Angola and now runs a national organization that works on for ex-prisoners. And he would say to me, ask, and he was a Muslim, and he said, ask the faith-based groups, are you giving people the help they need or the help that you think they need? It's a very simple question, but I think it really speaks to what you asked me, that are you actually helping people? Are you helping all people, regardless if they're Christian? Are you questioning why they're there in the first place? Why does the prison exist? Or are you just merely using it as a way to proselytize and to you know, convert people?
Well, answer that question on their behalf. Well, let's start with this. Did you ask them that question? And if so, what was their answer? And then give me your perspective on that.
Right. Well, I think that many people that come in, and there's a wide range of things. There are local churches that go into prison, then do Bible studies and do classes and do worship services. And then there are big programs like the education program that run, you know, have hundreds and hundreds of people there. There are the programs that run entire wings of prisons. But yes, they're, you know, the primary motive of an evangelical group is they believe that rehabilitation happens and a person is transformed when they accept Jesus or God into their life and they have a born-again transformation, and that will alter them, that will keep them from coming back to prison. There's, you know, sometimes those groups for people getting out provide other kinds of services, but they're contingent upon someone professing that faith. So I had really hoped going into this to see, well, if you're having daily regular contact with people in prison, perhaps you become radicalized by that, by seeing what it's like to be in a prison all the time. And you start doing things like questioning sentencing laws or solitary confinement or the way juveniles are treated in prison. But I didn't see that as much. And I think it would be really powerful if the religious groups like the Southern Baptists were to actually come out and take a stand on policy, and they don't. It's really focused on the individual, not the system, and that's very much in keeping with their theological beliefs, which is to convert the individual.
So I got a couple of questions. I mean, one, I guess, is did you find that it did that to you? I mean, you've been teaching in prisons. You obviously spent a long time in the research of this book. Do you find that? I mean, is that why you presuppose that they might feel that as well?
Right. I think, you know, when you work in a prison, you have to be complicit in that system to a certain degree. But I also think, you know, we're providing a secular college program that actually was women in the prison who organized themselves asked for and helped to build collaboratively with us. There's a tension that, you know, I think we should be doing more. We should be doing, in my state, we're working on bringing back parole. we're working on ending sentences for juveniles. I think you can work in the prison and also think more broadly about why is the prison there and what is the need for it. And what would it, in my book, I talk about at the end, slavery is a, you know, an analogy that many have made between prisons and slavery. And many of the faith-based programs in the South are on the site of former plantations and convict lease farms, which is just a new form of imprisonment after slavery was officially abolished. But it was evangelicals who, first in the UK and then the US, Methodists, Evangelicals, Baptists, who actually worked in the anti-slavery movement. And I think slavery was a way of life that we accepted as a norm, and we accept prisons as just, this is the way it has to be. And I think when I teach my students, both at the university and in the prison, we're asking, you know, what is the purpose of a prison? And what would be another way of thinking about punishment, about if we didn't have prisons, what would that look like? And I think just to ask that question conceptually, even if we can't get there, you know, anytime soon, is really important to question why the system exists, how it came about, and can something else take its place? So I hope that anyone who spends time in there would start to question that, especially when you see the vast numbers of people there and for how long, so many very long sentences and the loss of potential that for so many people that are languishing in prison.
So, I mean, as we look at what is, you know, sort of, I mean, it seems to me there are problems with this that run contrary to sort of some broad principles about the United States, right? I mean, that is the sort of the coercive aspects of this. You're in prison and you want air conditioning and you're in Florida, you got to come to the church. If you want to get your GED, it's got to be you got to learn about creationism or, I mean, on in that regard. I mean, I got to imagine too, though, I mean, if you're serving a life prison, a life sentence in Angola prison, there's a lot of positive aspects, like you mentioned, in terms of like contact with the outside, some sense of community. You do have access to these things. I mean, so are the reforms that, I mean, it seems like there's two sets of reforms. One is that there should be some reforms on a state or federal level in terms of not biasing or having an official relationship with these ministries because they're denominational. And then on the other hand, it's also you're calling for some type of reform within that movement in terms of the way that they perceive prisons.
Exactly. I think it's both things. I don't think it's going to be solved just by increasing religious diversity and other diversity of programs in prison, although that's certainly one solution. I was just speaking at Columbia Law School, and they have a project there on law and religion. This was on Monday, and they were saying, well, what are we going to do about this? We could do this, we could do that. And I said, but if you take away these programs, what's going to take their place? Is Columbia going to spend, you know, the money to hire somebody to run a college program in these prisons and give them college credit, which is really difficult to get universities to do? Are they going to build a library and a computer lab? So is this better than nothing? You know, that's a question that I have as well. And I think it's, so making more services available is one thing, making secular education available to everybody. And then another issue is, as you said, could you mobilize these religious groups to think about these broader questions politically and ethically?
I mean, and part of the problem is that there is a model here that we see in society outside of prison, right? Which is this privatization dynamic. And particularly now, at least on a federal level, where you have the rollback of private prisons has now been rolled back itself. And we're going to see an increasingly large amount of, I think, private prison building. I mean, a lot of that, I think, is going to come from sort of the, I'm trying to put it in their terms, the immigration sector right, in terms of their business. But aside from not really focusing on reforming prisons and aside from not focusing on rehabilitating these folks in a, I guess, a more pragmatic way than just mm-hmm. getting their hearts right with Jesus, are these entities in any way encouraging like a carceral state in some fashion? I mean, politically, well, are they doing it at all?
Well, what's really interesting is, you know, you mentioned at the very beginning the bipartisan support for criminal justice reform. You know, the ACLU partnering with the Koch brothers on Smart on Crime, the Right on Crime Coalition that has everyone from Grover Norquist to Newt Gingrich. You know, those people were educated by and became interested partially in criminal justice reform through the work of evangelical volunteers. So Chuck Colson, who went to prison for Watergate-related crimes, came out of prison, born again, and founded Prison Fellowship Ministry. And his and Pat Nolan's connections in D.C. were a lot of what spurred this idea of reform, because I think previous to other kinds of administrations that said two things. One, this idea, once a criminal, always a criminal. And you see that in the language of the, you know, the super predator of the 1980s and 90s, right? These really blanket stereotypical ideas about who's a criminal and that you're defined that way. Evangelicals are saying, no, you're not. You can be transformed. You can be transformed in this particular way, but no one is incorrigible. And that message, I think, you know, was they were able to get to people like Gingrich, people like Paul Ryan, the Smart on Crime policy advisor. When I met him, was going to brief Paul Ryan on criminal justice reform. So evangelicals, even though that those coalitions are really focused on things like public safety and fiscal responsibility in terms of prisons, they really came about because of the work of evangelicals. What will happen now with the Trump administration is uncertain, but you're right. There is going to be more private prison building. And some of those groups have come out against private prisons and about the abuses that take place in them. So it'll be fascinating. Florida just had a big case of a women's prison in which there was no heat or hot water. It's a private prison for, you know, months and months on end. And finally, a state representative started to investigate it. At the same time, they sort of tout themselves as having these faith-based prisons that rehabilitate people. So how do you, you know, reconcile those two models? And what happens when you start to build more private prisons where actually there's very little motivation in those to bring in any group that's going to keep people out of prison, because they function by continually filling their beds. That's how they make money.
Right. So these private prisons administrators are not going to bring in I'm sure there's a group, how to adjust to life outside of society or how to get a job group, because that's going to undercut their revenue source.
And they may be mandated to by the state, but what the quality of those services are going to look like is, you know, it's really hard to say. There's still a little oversight in those places. So, yeah.
And at what point do those private prison industries, they actually start creating subsidiaries to be those entities?
You mean to be sort of faith-based groups?
I don't know. I mean, sponsored ones to make sure that they get the ones that they want in there. And I also wonder, how much does the cost savings, how much does that also like sort of undercut the conservative impetus to reform prisons? Or is that something that I guess only time will tell?
Well, I think that goes right along with it, because, you know, someone once characterized the conservative view of prisons as, you know, equivalent to how they might see public education. They see it as an overbloated bureaucracy that's too costly. So anything that can make it more efficient and make it more run efficiently is going to be something that they support. You know, it's an interesting dynamic. It's one hand to have private religious groups coming in and running things that the state would do, you know, as volunteers or on their own, paying their own money to do it, versus, you know, having an entire private prison. And there was actually in Texas a person who was trying to build an entirely religious private prison, and it never got off the ground. This was about 3 years ago. And the idea was that prisoners would work and they would pay their own room and board and they would make it a profitable entity. So I'm curious if that model will continue or somebody will take it up or not.
Oh, geez. Yeah. I can only imagine. And
And one thing that was interesting, they kept saying, well, all of the guards will be Christians, right? So we'll be this entirely Christian prison, and so we won't have problems of, you know, how you treat people. Everyone will treat each other as Christians, right? But how do you do that when you're, you know, you're holding people captive and you have people who have incredible amount of power over them? I mean, the whole model, it was really fascinating. And again, it never transpired.
Didn't they have those already, and they called them plantations?
Yeah. And that's, it's so striking having spent time in a lot of these places in the South. You know, Angola is the size of Manhattan, and it was a slave plantation named, it's Louisiana State Penitentiary. It's called Angola because the plantation owner believed that the hardiest slaves came from Angola in Africa. And you still see men. The only time you see any officers who work there, correctional officers with guns, is they have big pistols and they ride on horses as they accompany men walking out to the fields. And it could be a tableau from, you know, the 1840s or something, instead of whatever, to, you know, 2016 or 17. One guy who was sentenced to committed a crime in Louisiana from Texas, he's from California, and he said to me when I interviewed him, he said, I couldn't believe when I came here, he's an African-American man, I couldn't believe, I just didn't think they had slave-type work that they were still having us do in this country. I didn't think that still existed, but it does. And, you know, that's really striking.
I was just going to ask you, is there anybody who is not a prisoner who you came across that said, like, I've been working here and I'm sort of shocked at how much this looks like we could be in a, watercolor painting from 1840?
Not the people who worked there, but certainly many people have, you know, made that comment about Angola, the prison in Texas that has a similar kind of Baptist Seminary College program that's on the site of another prison that was a plantation. So they don't make that analogy themselves, although the head of the prison ministry in the Texas prison, the seminary, would say, you know, we're trying to gather them like seeds and then send them out to sow the harvest, right, of Christianity to other prisons. And it's this sort of agricultural metaphor that really is reminiscent of slavery to a certain extent. But no, none of them really, none of the people who worked or ran those programs made that analogy.
Tanya Erzin, the book is God in Captivity, The Rise of Faith-Based Prison Ministries in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Thanks so much for your time today. We'll put a link to the book at majority.fm. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks. Wow, that's... glad we did a change of pace to not... oh, my God. Well, I mean,
I'm on mic. This is Attorney General Jeff Sessions. See, Angola was the best breeding ground for, or better yet, Angola was where a lot of enterprising immigrants came from.
Oh, God.
Unbelievable. I would put the odds of that Christian prison with the Christian guards, where they use their Christian prisoners to create a godly prophet, I would put the chances of that happening around 100%.
Amazing stuff.
We'll put a link to God in Captivity on the site at majority.fm. Folks, we're going to head into the fun half. I almost feel like we should do something fun right now, just to lighten the mood a little bit for people.
What brought you so down about Angola? There's nothing wrong with people taking pride in their physical labor. See, what we learned about the Negro is that their mind is degraded, but their bodies are stronger and their souls can still be cleansed. Oh, I'm sorry. I guess I'm on mic. This is Attorney General Jeff Sessions. I completely disavow everything that I just said. Not in the particulars, but in the generalities.
I didn't like the tone of my voice, and that this is the wrong microphone for me to use.
Wrong microphone to talk about the Negro matter with. I apologize. Oh, Ambassador Kislyak, how are you? Do you have a Negro problem? I guess you call it the Chechnya problem. Anyways, Gazprom.
You know what? Let's lighten the...
I have an interesting business opportunity for you.
So let's go. Let's do this Bill O'Reilly thing because it was really funny. We all laughed when he multiple times during this. Bill O'Reilly has got a question for America, folks. Oh, God. he is really, really amazed at just how much Trump derangement syndrome there is out there. Here he is. Listen to old Poppy O'Reilly.
Do you believe?
Wait, you got to go back a little bit. You got to say, I got a question for Americans. Oh, you pulled it? Okay. All right. So first he starts off by saying, I've got a question for America, because he had looked at a poll and he wants to say, I've got a question for America, and here it is.
Do you believe that the hatred toward President Trump has reached a dangerous level in this country?
Pause it. Okay, so he's got a question for America. Do you believe it? Actually, that was just rhetorical.
Do you believe that the hatred toward President Trump has reached a dangerous level in this country? The answer is yes. Whether you like the president or not, it's brutally unfair to try to undermine his administration, as some of the opponents are trying to do. We have the Democratic Party refusing to cooperate on anything. Mm. And now it looks like Senate rules will have to be changed to appoint Judge Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court because not enough Democrats will support the man. It's clear that Judge Gorsuch is qualified. It's also clear the most powerful Democrat in Congress, Senator Chuck Schumer, would look askance at any of his colleagues who support the judge. Many Democrat senators fear Mr. Schumer.
As you should.
There was hatred toward President Obama. There was. But in the first months of his tenure, there was no apparent undermining of his administration.
Pause it! Now, I don't...
Balls.
I don't think that any one of the 2 million people who regularly watch Bill O'Reilly, these old people...
Oh, my God.
These old, old people. And look, I know old people. I'm going to be an old person. But the dum-dums who watch Bill O'Reilly... can remember all the way back 9 years when Mitch McConnell said on day one, our number one job is to make sure he doesn't win re-election, where they didn't vote for anything. We were in the middle of a financial crisis. The bottom had fallen out. They wouldn't vote for anything. And... now, granted, it may have taken a couple of months for them to introduce the idea in Congress that he was not a citizen via legislation.
There was at least 3 months where people were not even calling him nigger in the Senate cloakroom. Exactly. He was given a massive opportunity to succeed.
Total opportunity. Here he is. Let's get
undermining of his administration. But now we have a climate of hatred where there are no rules. And the media feeds the beast
Pause
every
it.
Single day.
New rules like you got to give a sitting president a hearing on his nominee. New rules like we're going to filibuster in record numbers. Record numbers.
As a historian, I can tell you I've never seen the
Where are we
going to
go back? Because you got to get him actually saying those words in line. It's better.
This administration. But now we have a climate of hatred where there are no rules. And the media feeds the beast every single day. As a historian, I can tell you I've never seen the national press despise a president more than they do Donald Trump.
as a guy who has people ghostwrite books for me about assassinations of historical figures.
Put down that pipe and get my pipe up.
That's actually the only book I ever actually personally wrote.
Let me change that. Say, baby, put down that pipe and get my antique pipe up.
I mean, I guess in fairness, that piece of dialogue comes from a black crack dealer who O'Reilly was personifying in that groundbreaking 1990s thriller.
To be fair.
Because he's capturing the dialogue of the street.
Hey, mofo, pass the iced tea.
Yeah. Hey, mofo, where's my baby with my pipe? I also like
Andrea Bocelli.
I also like the idea of Chuck Schumer. I will be very disappointed. And when I'm disappointed, I will call your iPhone endlessly. You will hear from me throughout the day. It will be the most annoying Meshuggah experience you can imagine.
It sounds like to me that Claire McCaskill is going to get a look askance.
Hello, Miss McCaskill. Can you see my face? What is that face? Yes, that's the I'm disappointed in you face that Chuck Schumer makes when he's disappointed in you. No rugula for you, Gentile.
Somebody's going to lose their seat at Passover.
Everybody, gather around the bathroom. I'm going to use it and force you to talk to me while I do, like LBJ. Why is no one coming? No one listens. I have no control over my caucus.
I was just wondering this morning.
How Jewy is things going to get around here today?
No. Does O'Reilly ever have to apologize for anything?
Yes, actually. I think you should check in with Andrea Macris about that. Do you not know? Are you serious?
Is it the loofah
thing? You know what? She's the
falafel,
loofah.
Falafel.
Loofah.
Whatever. He called it a falafel. That's,
You know what we got to do? And I think, because Atreos just posted, I think, a link to it. I'm not sure. And I have it somewhere. There was a guy who did an opera based on what was released in the depositions, I think, about what he supposedly said to her. It's unbelievable. All right, folks, we're going to take a break, head into the fun half. You can join us in the fun half. How could I do that, Sam? Well, for just pennies a day, you can become a member of the Majority Report and support the show. And as our way of saying thank you, and as members know, we secretly like you better. That's what we say at the beginning of every member show. We like you better. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. And also, if you buy your crap from Amazon or jet.com, do so at majorityreportkickback.com. All you do is click on either one of those links, bookmark it, buy your crap through there, and we get a kickback. Also, I should tell you about the member show. It's commercial free. And as always, if you have financial issues, can't afford it, but... an extra hour or so of content every day to listen to would make your day better. Send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. We'll take care of you. All right, quick break, and God.
Stop it, Matt.
It's a professional show.
Stop sneezing.
We'll see you tomorrow or in the fun half. 646-257-3920. No.